this is the part that I thought was really cool, and we'll probably get a little tangential here, and then we'll go back to the book. But he talked about the first book ever being written was in the, using the alphabet was the Old Testament, which begins, not begins, but part of that is the Ten Commandments. And so he talks about the first commandment. I don't know my commandments, but basically you'll have no other gods before me, correct? Right. And how in that creation story, or in that commandment, like no woman was involved in the creation of the world at all. Like prior to Yahweh giving Moses the tablets, gods and goddesses were consorts to each other, and there was some sort of, you know, sex going on of some sort in order to produce the world. There was Father Sky and Mother Earth, and that was now completely eradicated by Yahweh, who didn't need women. And then the second commandment is don't make any images at all, no art whatsoever. And he pointed out that the second commandment is way above murder. And you would think that murder would be more important to tell people not to commit than make no graven images. And so that was a big, you know, no more images. Now we're going to go into this abstract alphabet, and you're commanded by your God that you can't use pictures anymore. So it puts that piece, that removed piece in there.
It removes the old technology. You see, media ecology is way more important than murder. The collectivity of the establishment is more important to preserve. So the God created the one-way song, Wyndham Lewis's poem, the one-way song of the phonetic alphabet, and so you had a patriarchal monad running the show, not interacting with anything, no dialogue, no reciprocity, no trade. You just come in and take over the local writing system and adapt it to your 26 letters or 22 letters. Mm-hmm. You know, you imperialize it. So that's the first, that's the step. Establishment. And they're saying, and you cannot retrieve the old technology or even make a new technology. We're sticking with this one. That's the second commandment. Don't make a new technology. Don't make a new image.
Mm-hmm. So then here's where I'm wondering what all this has to do with our power, like straight up our power to create, because they took all these commandments and put them in the Ark of the Covenant. Right.
Does he talk about the Ark of the Covenant?
Yes, he does, and he talks about how you put the Old Testament is they put that in the Ark of the Covenant. So I got, and he doesn't say this part, but I got to thinking while I was reading that, you know. So when we put, because I don't completely understand what Ion says when he's talking about we put our power in the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, I understand the concept of reclaiming my power, but I've never quite understood what it exactly was that I put in that box. But now I'm thinking that it was my ability to speak words,
yeah,
that oral tradition. Is that what we're reclaiming?
Yes, and
by
visual
taking it out
space,
of the box?
We're reclaiming more than orality. But talk about that later. But the point is visual space, the extension of the phonetic alphabet, which abstracted people's minds, that was the effect of the technology, to this external space. You didn't dialogue with it. It's just this abstract, almost ethereal geometric design that's sitting out there as a third term in your brain almost. You had the normal interaction between male and female and dialogic tactile cultures, and then all of a sudden it gets... An abstract space becomes more important than the dialogic of your normal interaction in life. So that abstraction is outside of yourself. So you begin to focus your devotional energies no longer on your ability to interact with people and maintain your position, your power, your autonomy. You'll find that, you know, pre-litter people, they're in a tribe and they're unified, but they're all pretty confident themselves. You know what I mean? It's like a rock band or a punk band or any band there. Every individual is kind of unique, right? They don't look in the camera the same way. They got different clothing. They all maintain their individual sovereignty. That's where tribal people are. Now you bring in this homogenizing, this standardization that happens before the God of externalized visual space. That's putting your power outside of yourself. That's extending the eye. The eye space, it dominates. It's like a pyramid. The eye at the top of the pyramid, it dominates the whole pyramid. Now, that's a visualization. The actual life of those who lived and built the pyramids was not visual. They were tactile and oral and had vibrant lives, Ion says. They didn't mind being slaves because they didn't feel dominated by anything. They just worked on common projects. So you put the eyeball at the top, you're making an order, hierarchical order, and that's outside of yourself, right? So you're putting your power, right, your natural energy flow outside of yourself, and that's the beginning of the Christian visual one God space. And so the ark, then the ark has the bones of Joseph and a few other things they brought from Egypt and whatever, and then they put the cracked commandments, I think, in there. So that becomes this box, and that's a visual expression of visual space. It's visual, and they separate it from you, and no one's allowed around it. Now, Ion has added other dimensions about what actual technology was in there. Modern technologies were in there that, you know, Schlein wouldn't know about and wouldn't discuss. But the do you understand that putting the power outside of yourself was the, quote, sin of creating visual space as a collective meme that people started to operate within? They operate within it, and it was new. You know, they've been thousands of years of everybody yapping. It's like endless talk shows, endless people yakking and playing music and drumming and no linear order. All of a sudden, this whole new experience of having linear order was a novelty, and so everybody accepted it. And that's what Ion says. Uh-huh. We fell into that power of the ark put outside ourselves and enjoyed the contrast it caused or the new sensation. So that's what's happening there.
Well, it makes that so much less scary. I mean, because when you think about the Ark of the Covenant and only know about it from watching Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones.
Well, that's the way it was.
Think about,
wait a minute. Yeah. I'm talking about the McLuhan level with not bringing any woo-woo in. Ion brings the woo-woo in and claims it can prove it. And it was some. It had some energy in there, some technology that could zap people. And that's why you weren't allowed. The average Jew wasn't allowed to touch it. Only the Levites had it, and they would. If a Levite had to go in and be near the ark, they put a rope around him in case that he got sucked into whatever the vortex was in there.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, drag his body back at least, and you would be tested. If you wanted to be a Levite, you had to. I think that's what Ion said. You had to go up there and touch the thing, and if you didn't die, okay, you're a Levite. If you didn't, if you did die, you didn't make it. You lost the job. So, but that's the mystery landscape. That's what Ion's adding to all this history. We're just talking about normal mainstream bullshit history right now, right? With Leonard Schlein dealing with what's given, what his eye can see when he went to these architectural places and build up a bunch of data. But you can make interesting patterns within that given, in those given assumptions, right? Which is what I'm saying, is that we started to externalize.
And to me, I found this comforting because when I'm struggling with being in my power, if all it is restoring my sensory ratio imbalance, that's not scary. That's exciting. You see, so coming to this conclusion took away some fear of being zapped by the ark.
Well, I'm going to bring that fear back in. I'm going to bring that fear back in because restoring your sensory balance is part of the Ionic agenda, but you don't want to be limited to your sensory realities. I remember when I read Cosmic Awareness stuff back in the late 60s, they had four or five levels of limbo, and there was one like being inferior or less than first level, then there was another level, and then the third level was self-awareness expanding, and then the fourth level, I think, was your senses getting integrated. The fourth or fifth level of limbo, that means you're not ascended, was getting your holistic sensory ratio in ecological balance and fully operating, like pre-literate people were. Even though pre-literate people, they were seduced by visual space. They didn't see that coming, and they weren't ready. They had not they had no mechanism defense for it. But once you're, anyways, the pre-literate man, that's in the chapter in Mechanical Bride from Da Vinci to Holmes, where the aristocratic Indian noble savage kind of guy got all his senses working, and he's not like the visually limited, visually biased middle-class merchant. You remember in those novels? That was the theme.
Oh, yeah.
So here you have this, fourth or fifth level of limbo, according to cosmic awareness, was the integrated senses. Then the sixth level was ecstasy. So you're zapped out on ecstasy and bliss, but that was still a level of limbo. It wasn't pure plane of essence cosmic awareness. So I'm adapting that to having your sensory ratios is organized properly is not the ascended being. It's a level of limbo. Ecstasy, the bliss on the drops, or the bliss you get with the ionic products, is still a level of limbo. The ascended person is not subject to that. So I'm using awareness and ion to sort of deflate your happiness about retrieving your sensory balance.
So let me know how much of a cockroach I still am.
Yes, yeah. I try to make you less renegade if you back down. But no, it's on the way.
Off.
What?
Shut up, Bob. You can't do it.
Your sensory integration. Less. I know. But look, your sensory integration is not the end. It's a way station on the on your ascension process. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I still think it's neat that I thought of that.
You know, that's
the whole thing.
No, it's good. It's useful. You know, you have McLuhan dealing with holistic sensory life, the second quadrant on my chart. The third quadrant is Thompson. He's in the 70s. He goes further than McLuhan. He brings in the chakras and this other non-visible, non-sensory aspects, what some people call mysticism. That's why he is more resonant in the 70s than McLuhan, and that's why he's the next phase on my chart. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, but since people are naive about all of this, they don't know anything about any of it, it's good to have the notion of reintegrating your senses, and that's what the 60s were about. They'd go to Esalen to get in touch with all their senses. People took LSD to get in touch with all their senses. Why was that a big popular meme? Because television was pretty close to presenting all your senses. It was the new medium, and wow, look at this. That technology is a full sensory operated thing. I want to be like that. I don't want to be just stuck reading a book page. Or just inside my my mind's eye, you know? So so then you go into the satellite global theater of the 70s. It's not just television. Television is just one medium mixed in with the computers and tape recorders and cable TV. You get a non-visualizable sensory dynamic going, and that was first understood as Eastern chakras and invisible energies. That's how people, you could say, they brought in the sixth sense, the psychic sense, the psychic boom of the 70s. All this was dealing with the media past the television world. As the instant replay comes in 1970, and then as you get more electronic and beginning to get digital media in the 70s and 80s, that is taking you beyond the five senses, and you've got to come up with new modalities. And so that's why everybody went into the new age culture and invisible ideas, invisible energies, and chakras.
Mm-hmm.
You see? See, that's where Thompson's different, and reflecting the media environment of the 70s where McLuhan didn't. McLuhan was one step back. So, well, let's just, that's a digression. So,
it's
important. No, it's important. Yeah,
it's very important. Yes.
So I'm saying that, yes, you've retreated. This is where you go up and down my chart, and since you don't know any of it, you didn't know this processing that was going on the last 100 years, you jump back into the McLuhan idea of reintegrate your senses. That's a new idea for you. And so there's also not a linear hierarchical order on the chart. Okay, the Thompson quadrant on one level does happen after McLuhan, but you still need to develop your sensory integration or the ideas you think you have about it, and you can go and enjoy McLuhan, right? And then you would go read Thompson with other purposes. So this is the juggling of the memes in Dobbstown.
Okay.
How you do it. So
yeah,
we get
how you do it.
Yeah. So, okay, alphabet and the goddess, what's the next point? And Carolyn, are you ready to say something? Carolyn doesn't have anything to say right now, so go ahead.
Okay.
Your next point.
All right. Now, remember, too, that his thesis is that the alphabet caused misogyny. So that's what he's leading towards. So it's different in...
Misogyny is the huge disservice of patriarchy, right?
Correct.
It causes patriarchy, and the women really get beat up compared to the way they were on a voluntarily equal situation, it seemed, before the alphabet.
Right. So that's where we're going now with what I'm going to tell you that he was talking about, is he's trying to build a case for that. And the guy just seems like such a sweetheart. I don't know what his motivation was for writing this. I'm sure it was interest. I'm sure it was everything that he said it was, that he was thinking about the left brain, right brain thing, whatever. But he just seems like such a mensch, like just the sweetest.
Why? Because like he's talking about, is it saving women? Is that what you're falling for?
Not just that, because I don't really fall for that, because I don't, because of you. You wouldn't let me anyway. You'd be like, what are you talking about? Straight up. But his use of language,
his poetry. He's sensitive. He's a poet.
He is. He's a beautiful writer, and just really seems... He seems to be writing it from a place of loving women. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Say that again. What'd you say? What about loving women?
I think he's writing this from a place of loving women. Like he's playing tribute.
Well, that's the romantic poet myth. That's the romantic poet. That's the Keats and the Shelleys. They reacted, in 200 years ago to the patriarchy and would start favoring, retrieving, I guess, Greek knowledge that included the goddesses, and they would be seen as the romantic lover, the sensitive lover, concerned about the woman. That's what he's retrieving here. He's being that kind of poetic sensibility.
He is, and the book is written in that sensibility. There's a loveliness to it.
Right. Now, that is what we call, what McCune calls the first romantic movement. That's Keats, Shelley, and the rest of those guys, Wordsworth, Coleridge, at the time of the French Revolution. When you get into the electric age, the telegraph, 1850s and 60s, that's when you no longer are celebrating nature and women. The Pre-Raphaelites were part of that. You're now dealing with the raw fact. We're in a new virtual reality here, and that's where the French poets come in, Rimbaud, Baudelaire, and the symbolists. And they're the guys that influence Eliot and Pound, which influences McLuhan, and you'll see a lot is made of that in Don Thiel's book, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan. So you have Schlein talking about technology, but from the first romantic movement's perspective, and he's confronting the second romantic movement, that's the symbolists and those guys in France, as they say, wait a minute, there's a technology here that's almost like a new kind of nature that obsolesces the old nature we've been writing poems and lake poems to. You know what I mean? See, that's the subtle point there.
I do.
Go ahead. So that's what you're responding to. You're romantic.
Yeah.
You're romantic.
Yeah. Oh, I would love to meet this man. I want to give him a hug.
But he died. I think he's gone.
Yeah.
Is he dead? Oh.
Yeah. Oh. He died a few years ago.
Oh, well, my characters in my novels can't meet him because the novel takes place in 2012. But they can talk about him. They can go to a class. Okay.
You could have a memorial. They're at the funeral, and then they're all remembering their experiences with him.
I can do that. I totally can do that. Okay, so then he starts to talk about...
You know that his daughter... Here's the thing. His daughter made a big movie a couple of years ago that I think Oprah and everybody was promoting. Look that up. You might be interested in what his daughter is doing with his legacy.
Sure.
Was it just a... Find out the name. Put her name...
Documentary
or something. Yeah. I saw it. It might be eco-fascist. It might be in the world of gore. But you just look up his family name, get the daughter, click on her, and then you can look at the movie. And okay.
Let's do it.
Okay, but Marianne Williamson is probably given a credit in it,
Oh, I'm sure she's probably in it. Like, hello.
Yeah.
Okay, so then he starts to talk about evidence of goddess disintegration post-literacy, post-alphabet. So he's talking about Greece, ancient Greece, and the three main goddesses, Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite, and how Hera was eaten by Zeus and then born out of him.
Right.
And then Athena emerged fully formed out of Zeus's brain, and Aphrodite, someone's balls got cut off and thrown in the sea. I don't know how that went, but anyway, that's how Aphrodite was born. And so in all three cases...
Wait, Aphrodite was born out of the sea?
Yeah, somebody cut off somebody's nuts and threw it into the sea.
Oh, okay. And it came from man.
Blood.
All comes from man. So here's this
all
fake beginning, a culturally conditioned idea that everything's coming from the man, right? So that's obviously bullshit from Ion's perspective, because there's no beginning, but you can see the artificiality of it, but it's also a total product of the effect of the writing. See, that's what's fun.
Correct.
Within normal knowledge, we can get patterns that are almost scientific based on knowing these effects.
Right.
Yeah.
So now these women, not only do they come from, so they have no mother. So the concept of mother is now removed from the three main Greek goddesses. Then he started talking about looking at different cultures, whether they wrote or not, and then how those cultures treated their women. And he compared and contrasted Sparta and Athens. And if you look at Sparta, we have no evidence that they did anything at all with writing. They didn't write anything down at all.
Right.
They were warriors, and they didn't write. But Athens did lots of writing, and so you would think that since they wrote a lot, no, you wouldn't think that. I don't know what I was going to say. But what I was going to say is that Sparta treated their women better. They were allowed to hold property. They were allowed to dress in non-restrictive clothing and have a more equal shot at everything in life.
Let's hold it there. Now, what's interesting is that Sparta gets a bad name. They're a robotic, no personality kind of culture. And Athens has all these wonderful personalities, Socrates and everybody. And you're pointing out, which probably, assuming he's got correct historical information, whatever he cites for his research, does he cite anybody who noticed this pattern before him? Or did he see this pattern first?
I don't know. I'd have to look at the bibliography. He didn't cite sources throughout. There's probably a bibliography or whatever, but this is all.
You don't have numbers as you read through a chapter.
No.
You don't have numbers that you can look up. Okay,
no.
So it's not an academic kind of book. I see.
No, it's pop.
All right. Right. Okay,
definitely.
So let's assume it's good. It's right. And that's a pretty interesting point between Sparta and Athens, because LaRouche will talk about how bad Sparta was and how great Athens was, because LaRouche, who's in the newspaper visual space quadrant on my chart, he's all for visual space values, and he, like Rush Limbaugh, and they are celebrating the individuation but patriarchically controlled Athens versus the robotic, almost oriental Sparta.
Well, and I would have thought if it would have just been brought up at a cocktail party and you told me, said Sparta or Athens, I would have picked Athens too.
Yeah, everybody goes with Athens.
Yeah.
And that's a very good, that is a cultural meme in the West based on literate bias that you wouldn't be aware of. And Sparta being an oral, robotic oral society, oral societies, tribal societies, pre-literate, they look robotic to literate man. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
It's got an aggressive, anti-Westerner, image. That's a very good point.
Sure.
So if you clear out that assumption, then you are not subject to it, and that should give you power, according to Dobbstown, that you're not hypnotized by that assumption. That's why we're doing this secular knowledge through McLuhan and that. You see?
Yeah, I do. And then he talked about the three major philosophers of the time and whether they wrote or not, and their views on women, and Socrates loved women, and he didn't write anything.
Right,
everything was a conversation. Okay, and then Plato started to write Socrates' stuff down, and Aristotle followed him. And got progressively more misogynistic.
These guys, it's like a drug. They're writing and writing, and the women maids are coming around, and they're interrupting his thinking, his private thinking and writing, and he just gets pissed off at the women around him.
Right.
Because he's not engaging in an oral interactive situation. He's by himself writing.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
He's in his own rocket ship.
Talked at one point about, you know, putting all of the emphasis of wisdom, like casting it on to Sophia. So it was a woman, but it wasn't really a woman. You know, it was
right.
this mythical woman. And then having all their erotic feelings be toward the thirst for knowledge rather than pussy.
Who had the thirst for knowledge, men or Sophia? I didn't get that.
Men. But they're, and I said that last thing just to be silly and
right.
gross.
No, that's not right. It's not
like
gross.
To do that.
No,
like
it's not
to do
gross.
That.
We need more of that.
It's not gross. We need more of that. They made wisdom into a woman, but a disembodied woman. So they weren't in love with a woman. They were in love with knowledge in an erotic way. So their sexuality became...
They love the word. And so the sex object, women, has to become an abstract, a visual space icon to represent
right.
sex. It has to be abstracted.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
And rather than craving sex, they craved knowledge. Like, they were just so hungry for the abstract knowledge. They just wanted to sit around and read and write.
So that's where the muse. So since now William and Thompson points out that the brain and the sex organs, they're intertwined, right? Maybe people have that with a Kundalini experience. So since mm-hmm. knowledge, the brain activity is linked to the sexual energies, in visual space they have to become abstracted. So Sophia, I was going to say something. I already said this, but there was another aspect. They abstract. Oh yeah, the sex act is for the abstract brain, and they have to have the sex in there. So they got to have a woman in there, but she has to be an abstract woman. So that makes that's why she's preserved. They have to keep the sexual energy level in there.
Yeah, well, and I think the sexual energy was just displaced in that way.
Yeah, like, it went from the going edge to the brain. It went
right.
up into the abstract third term, Augustine called it, the third space in the brain, because the alphabet resolved the endless arguments in oral cultures between this or that. But when you had an abstract space, something written, and that was what was to be beholden, this definition, this quote truth, that was above the fray between the yin and the yang, you see?
Yes.
So they're in love with the third term, and they have to have the muse aspect in there, and the sexual energy goes up into there as an abstract archetype that is supposed to
right.
just sort of hover around and help you.
Right. Interesting.
Now, here's something to add to this. The Everine said, famous Christian, the patristic fathers, they all smoked marijuana or whatever was around, because the goal back then, once, you know, Christianity started, was you had to go through Scripture and come up with a new twist, a new wrinkle, a new interpretation. And you do that by getting stoned, and then you could look at the multi-levels of meaning and come up with something unique. That's how you got your identity, by coming up with a new interpretation. So a lot more smoking of dope is going on than we would, 50 years ago would have believed. Just want to throw, that's what the Everines add to it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What about mushrooms and stuff? Because sometimes...
Yeah, they did that. And they would do these things, whatever was available to get the mind, you know, psychoactive, so that it loosened up the linear effect of reading one meaning in the text. And it's not even that linear compared to once print comes in. Print creates what you call equitone. But it's multi-tone in medieval culture. But the idea is to appreciate the many levels. You get the four levels of exegesis. And any kind of drug or stimulant that will help you break up your dull mind and it's running along one track, you want to go multi-track, that was encouraged. All for the effect, the goal, the great trophy of writing something that was new.
Right.
They're all working for it, to write something new.
Right. Okay, so let me go on.
Yeah, this is good.
Then he talks about, just giving an example of how quickly people became literate, and he mentioned that in Pompeii, you know, that city
yeah.
where all the, okay, that there was graffiti all over in like lower class people's walls.
Right.
So what he was trying to, so everybody was writing, basically.
Okay.
So then, now we're going to move to Jesus. Then he starts talking about Jesus and how Jesus actually was very feminine and never wrote anything down.
Right.
And so after Christianity was founded, women flocked to the new Christian church and were allowed to be priests and perform baptisms and do that, all that kind of good stuff.
That's the influence of Jesus?
Yeah, that was just Jesus before they started writing the New Testament. So
right.
There was the Old Testament, then there was Jesus, and he walked around without purse or script and talked. It was oral. He was telling stories, sitting around, doing his thing.
See, that could be the meaning of the Mary, a media way to look at the Jesus-Mary relationship that the Gnostics and the Da Vinci Code make a big deal as a sexual thing, was that Jesus was attracting the woman by his media style, not whether they were married or not. You know what I mean?
That's a new way to look at that. That is a new way to look at that.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And keep in mind, too, as I proceed through, it wasn't like this was like the goddess. There was an ebb and flow to this. It's been a rise and fall of the goddess over time.
Yeah.
So we're going to come back into a peak here, and then we'll go into another valley as I go through this whole timeline here. So, yeah, Jesus, before the New Testament, I love what you just said. That's so interesting. And then they started to write Jesus' words down as the new Testament, and instead of being a message of peace and love and fishes and loaves and kiss everybody and turn the other cheek, it became a message of sin and guilt and suffering and death. Jesus' message.
Yeah, your body is fallen in relation to visual space. Visual space is more important than your body. Therefore, your body is, and its historical bias, orality, tactile, that is what sinned. It's the wrong sensory mix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it becomes less than the visual archetype, which is this abstract something devoted to the Trinity.
Yeah.
So
now
this is what I would call Peter's church. This is not Jesus' church. This is Peter's church. It's the writing church, the written church.
Right. And isn't it, on this rock, we will build our church. I mean, we're going to set it in stone. Once you write something down, it's set in stone. So maybe he wasn't even talking about an edifice.
Right. Just for those theologians who are listening and think there's a naivety, McLuhan talked about the argument between Peter and Paul. In whatever Christian history that McLuhan was citing, Peter wanted to keep the religion to the tribe of Christians. Paul was the one who wanted to move it out and spread it horizontally around the world and, in a way, make a time bureaucracy to counter the military bureaucracy of Rome. So, paradoxically, I'm saying the writing is Peter's church, but not in the way Peter is more oral and wants to keep it in-house, and Paul's visual wants to spread it dogmatically through writing. So, actually, Peter might not have been that way. He's not the cause of writing, but what Ian calls is the Peter's Church, Roman Catholic Church, built on Peter, not Jesus. That is what you're describing, the beginning of visual space, changing the dynamic of its methodology and ideology.
Yeah, interesting. And he also mentioned at this time that the New Testament was being written, that early Christian art shows Jesus with a book. There's lots of pictures of Jesus walking around with a book, but he didn't write anything down. He didn't read anything. He didn't have a book.
Now, that it could be a visual pun. Jesus is commenting on the visual tradition. That's his enemy. You know, it's like McLuhan used to say, if I talk about it, it doesn't mean I'm for it. If I'm holding a book up, it doesn't mean Jesus is for it. He would say, it is written, but I say unto you. So that may be accurate in the way I'm saying it than the simple way. Oh, look, he's supporting books. That may not be what is meant. You get what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. They're both interesting.
But he says that. Schlein takes the simple view that it's weird they're showing Jesus with a book, right?
Right. And he's saying it's because that was
the writing
culture.
Means.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was the new technology. So then, that was the new myth.
It was. So then he gets.
Now here's an interesting point, and you know how that movie Kaleidoscope, or what's that one that everybody liked for a few years on the internet with Jordan Maxwell. Whatever it was, it showed how the Christian religion had all the pagan sun worship all the way through,
yeah,
going back, you know, okay? Jesus, if gods are our new technologies, and then they're anthropomorphized in Greek reality, Greek myth, Jesus is following that trend. He's holding up the new technology, and he's a god identified with that technology. That fits what I'm saying, that the gods were extensions of some new invention. So that image you're talking about is... Yeah, go ahead.
Jesus becomes the Bible. I mean, the whole...
Yeah.
Even though all of the... Even though Islam and Judaism and Christianity were all the Old Testament, like, when we think of the Bible, we don't think of it without the New Testament now.
Right.
The Bible is a Christian book. We think of it's the Torah, if it's the
right.
Jewish version. And so Jesus is associated with the book, big time. That's
or it would
amazing.
Be a manuscript back then. It would be a manuscript, right? It would not
That's
be
cool.
a printed book yet.
Well, I don't know. He's holding books in these pictures. I don't know what it would be. Would it be a scroll?
Probably. Something like a manuscript or a scroll. It wouldn't be the printed book.
Right. Until
anyway, it's written literature. And the book per se, within the history of visual space, is only a recent form. There were many writing
right.
forms after the phonetic alphabet, you know, in different
yes.
ways. So he represents one of those earlier forms.
Yes.
That's pretty neat. Okay, good. That's
pretty neat.
Yeah.
Okay, so then he talks about the collapse of Rome. You know, they ran out of papyrus and literacy was lost and we entered the Dark Ages.
Yes, Egypt took away the papyrus. Does he say why Egypt did that or how
no.
they did it?
No.
Yeah, I haven't read too much on that.
No.
And Harold Innes' book goes into it a little bit, but I haven't seen much, and I haven't done real diligent research, about what were the particulars of that.
In my reading with you since November, I thought they ran out.
Okay, so they ran out, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be like if we all of a sudden cut down all the trees or whatever. Like there's
right.
no more natural resources for it. And papyrus wasn't like paper. Wasn't it a lot heavier? Wasn't it more almost like a piece of canvas?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Now, is Egypt in a dark age? In the dark ages, are they? Do they suffer?
I don't know.
Okay. That remains
I have no
the,
idea.
Checked into,
then, he's,
right.
then he's kind of moving into Europe after there.
Yes.
So I can't answer that. I do not know.
So he finds the women are retrieved. Matriarchy or the women renew their roles, leadership roles, or helping leaders more directly. It happens in the Dark Ages, right? So from the women's
right.
point of view, the Dark Ages are a great time.
They're fantastic. So that's the time of courtly love, and women are worshipped, and women are going back to lead in the monasteries again. And then
yeah.
there's a reappearance of Mary. All the fabulous cathedrals are built to Notre Dame, Our Lady.
And this is striking.
Mary,
this is striking if you know that, you know, 500 years before, that would be impossible. And he's showing you the era when that would be impossible, and people don't realize when there were no women allowed in the imagery. And then later there is. So he helps you see the shifts in history.
Yes. And then he talks also about the phenomenon of the Black Madonna during this time, and how... Always in ancient cultures, the Earth Mother was black.
Mm.
She's the color of the earth, the dirt.
Right, right.
So
that becomes a dominant image. You know, I don't know. I have a book on the Black Madonna. I only looked at it. I didn't read in detail. But do the African writers say that that's the African roots of Christianity or something? Do they go with that racial interpretation? Or
I don't,
they don't
know.
Even
yeah. Years ago,
so
I don't know. Could be. But in this context, it was supposed to be represented again of the Earth Mother,
right.
That renews everything in the spring.
So you see, on a bigger science fiction comedy level, humans are technologically determined by their means of communication. They go all patriarchal when they got a lot of written materials. Then they go acoustic, and they all start going back to the old retrieved earthy images. And it shows how automatic history was in retrospect as you look at it, media as the ground. You know, humans are pawns of the media system.
Right. It's true.
Yeah.
Okay. So then we started to have a renaissance men. So men started to come back on the scene.
Well, that's the printing press. The printing press does that. Yeah.
1453, books are cheap, easy, and available. And so then after that, Protestant Reformation. So they got rid of Mary. They got rid of all the images in the church. The churches, Protestant churches aren't big, beautiful cathedrals with all the different smells and incense and bells.
Multi-sensory.
And light. Yeah.
Yeah. White color is tactile. They lose their tactile color in the fullness, that multi-sensory richness, and they look like a black and white page. You got a blank, plain page.
Yes. He made that exact point. They were dressed in the colors of ink and paper.
Right.
Yep.
And that's the Puritan.
That's the Puritan. Oh, that's just so boring. We gather together to ask the Lord's blessing.
you mean the bad oral singing of the Protestants?
Yes.
They can't sing.
Yes.
They've lost their oral sensitivity. Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah.
And then
but remember, it's a novelty. You have to remember how noisy the Middle Ages was. Bells going all the time, all day long. The cacophony. You have to realize, why did humans go for it? They weren't forced to. They loved the new silence. It was a new experience to read it silently, you know what I mean? And to have no color distract you. It's actually a new gimmick, like, you know, Macintosh computer. It's a new reality. Mm-hmm. So you have to show people fall for, are seduced by a new, different sensory environment.
Mm-hmm. He called it the silence that speaks.
Yeah.
Reading is the silence that speaks.
That's right, You're focusing on your sub-vocalization as you're reading and making a big deal out of what you're thinking and reading. You're really like, wow, we got to get this right. This sentence isn't even punctuated right. Got to bring in grammar, and you got to make sure everybody's on the same page. So then you bring in empirical science, making experiments where the results are replicated by the next lab like a book page. The book's got to look alike. You see? So science goes totally, what they worship as science in the Masters of Sex series about the 50s and that study of sex by Masters and Johnson, I think it was. The kids, the peasants are all involved with the icon of science. It's like the last gasp of this abstract thing where you have an experiment and you repeat the effects. And that's supposed to be significant, that you can repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And that people are subject to that.
Right. He did touch too on like money being an extension of barter, and you know, it's just really bad.
Well, it becomes an extension of the printing press, and then that's when then central bankers and elites can conspire and play off one national economy against another. With their printed money, that's not possible. You have no fulcrum to stand on before the printing press.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that. You said it was.
So Alex Jones and that ilk are complaining about a phase, say, from 1600 to 1800, or maybe even up to 1900. They're complaining about the effect of the printing press, where the bankers,
right.
the banksters play off one country against another, right, for the book.
Right. Yep.
On behalf of the books.
Yep. So then he talks about the religious wars and how all of those religious wars that cropped up were conducted during what was called the Age of Reason. And how...
the light of reason, the light of the page,
right.
The lights reflecting off the page.
Yeah. Crazy. and actually said, and I thought this was really interesting, that our culture at that time was psychotic. Oh, yeah, and that's why, too, I forgot. That the men went crazy and started killing their own women. That was the first time in history ever. Like, it used to be you'd go over and you'd kill all the men to steal their women.
Yeah.
But there was never a time in history before where, like, men were killing their own women. But that was the witch hunts.
Right, and that's in the 1600s. That's after the printing press has been locked in for a couple hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So here we are, the only...
This is almost like the explosion of the sun, the supernova of visually biased, book-oriented culture before the multiple pages of the newspaper and the telegraph come in the middle of the 19th century. So before a new technology is going to make the whole book thing irrelevant, there's a fanatic fighting over the old environment. It's almost like, well, this is a losing environment. Anybody can be in charge of the central bank. I'm going to go in there and get it, you know, take over.
Yeah.
Because it's actually starting to weaken as a real environment.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a side thing. But anyway, so in the middle of it, they're killing each other and killing their own women.
Right.
You know, all for this abstract thing, which is not silly. I wouldn't call it psychotic. If you're devoted to the effect of the printing press, which is the third space in your mind, and collectively it's an outside space for abstract heaven, that's fully justified within that programming. That's what they're all excited about. They love the effect of the printing press.
They loved it. And then from here... He really wrapped up kind of quickly, which I found interesting that there was so much in the beginning, you know, going through all the anthropology and the Tony Hill walking and the
biology.
Brain and the pelvis and all that. And then he pretty much skips along to his point, which is that we're at the end of a 5,000-year reign of patriarchy and, you know, really touches... very briefly on the fact that photography did for images what the printing press did for writing. So we had more.
What does he say? He doesn't know how to get into what's happened since 1970. You know, he arrives at 1968, 69 with the beginning of Women's Lib, and he's hoping to revive it or explain it or something, but it gets simple because he doesn't know how to analyze the digitization, the body drift that Croker writes about, the digitization and the multibodies. He doesn't know about that, and it gets way more complex.
He doesn't know about the multibodies. Right. So we can draw a real satisfying conclusion. For me, it didn't get meaty toward the end, because if you don't know you have five bodies, then you really can't speak to anything.
Your cause of feminism or retrieved matriarchy or whatever for women becomes too weak, because
political.
It did get it political and limited, because by the 80s, you've got feminists wanting to come back and be housewives again because they can't take the burnout of corporate culture, and the teenagers don't care anymore, so they're all for Madonna's image. And so his analysis wouldn't work past 1980, say. And
there was one cool thing that he said. He had one point that was cool. And then we can just discuss, because this is pretty much where it ends.
Yeah.
And then I want to tell one personal thing that's so cool too. But what he said was, you know, when we wrote with pens in manuscript culture, we were writing just with our right hand, so it would still produce a left brain dominance. So that was highly masculine. And then came the typewriter, which we've discussed, because I love that theme. And in the whole thing, women were sick of being dictated to, so they went out and learned how to type.
Yeah.
But only women learned how to type. So that was tactile, because you're using your left hand, but only women did it, because men didn't need to. Well, then the computer was invented. So suddenly men needed to learn how to type. So now men were typing and using both the left hand and right hand to form sentences, which broke up the heavy left brain dominance. And so now he said, you know, men are better fathers, and this whole...
because of the keyboard.
Because of the keyboard.
That's
kind
cool.
of a stretch. Cool. and it's pretty much where it ended. But there's still...
You know what he's missing? That he's saying the men are better fathers, but fathers of families are a minority almost. There's no families anymore. The digital multi-body thing scatters the battle between the sexes and makes every person become a warrior under themselves, and they'll have a baby under any condition. Right? Not the domestic conditions, though. He doesn't deal with that. But I remember when I looked at the book.
The family's obsolete and too expensive anyway, and has since the 50s. And
so
anyone
with
a car doesn't have a family.
Right,
anyone
so even though
car
it's a neat point. Right. Anyone who had a car, what did you just say?
Anyone who has a car is in a family.
Well, you know, that's what McLuhan said years ago. He said, you're quoting
him.
He said, if you have a car, you can't have a family. Because it breaks
up. And you and Carolyn don't have a car. Yeah.
Right. So we have a family, even though no kids. Well, we do have kids, but we never see them. They're out there making their own web pages, you know.
Right.
But the... Okay, I just want to say, I remember when I looked at that book, late 90s, when it came out in the store, I went to the end to see how much he dealt with today, and I saw how weak it was. That's why I didn't read it. I said, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how to deal with the present. But I thought, we do have we got a copy, Carolyn has it, and I never read it, but I always thought, someday I got to go read that, just to get those historical left hemisphere details. And also, I bought his art and physics book just for that, but it doesn't grab me because I'm dealing with something more amazing in the present with what I've been talking and thinking about the last 30 years. You know, it's more fun to think myself. I'm writing to myself.
Right.
I'm reading my own books. Right?
The McLuhan piece in The Alphabet versus the Goddess is teeny tiny. It's very interesting. He did use it to influence this thesis that he had, but the thesis that he had involved a lot of other pieces that, though I found very, very interesting, I don't think, like, really ultimately matter all
right,
that
because
much.
You know what that is? He, being a neurosurgeon, is an expert on the biology, the chemical body. And McLuhan said biology and the chemical system held the mean together for people's sense of what they were at the end of the 19th century. And he says, you know, biology is gone by the 20s under the radio effect. People don't know it, but it's gone. But that's why they allow the peasants to go to school and memorize biology, because it's obsolete. That's when the peasants get it, or, you know, the working classes in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and then after World War II. So the reason it would not be interesting is that biological knowledge that he's an expert on as a neurosurgeon is very Western and limited around the chemical body and doesn't deal with the new knowledge that people have from different cultures all over the place now. That's why it wouldn't hold up to you. Biology is obsolete.
Right. I think
biological
really
metaphor.
I think he could be really interested in what Carolyn is doing if he wasn't dead, but maybe when the guff empties, we can meet
See, you can have in your novel, you can have people, you know, going to Leonard, being impressed, and having other characters saying, no, he's missing this and that. And you could actually critique Leonard Schlein, like we're doing now, in your novel. And that would be interesting for the reader.
I can. And the protagonist works at a media firm, so her boss can easily be into McLuhan. Like, she could come and say, I'm going with Val to this Leonard Schlein thing, and he can be like, oh, well, I know the real deal. You know?
Right.
And the other thing that was just, what do I want to say? It seemed like, and I could be wrong, because I have no evidence of this, it was just a vibe, like that somehow feminists would be really, really excited about this book because he pretty much predicted the return of the goddess due to a restoration of a more appropriate sensory ratio balance because of TV.
Well, he didn't predict it. He writes this in the late 90s when it's come and gone.
Correct. Okay.
But anyways,
But he still... Right, you're right. My point isn't really that it is that he's.
But feminists might like it. It's like at least. Well, this guy, he's on our side in retrospect. Isn't that what Marshall calls Ion calls past blue perfect or something? That's what might have been.
Yeah.
Had we won the ERA in 1976, then Leonard would have been an advisor to our presidency.
Okay. And so my point is that a feminist, which I am not, would read this book and be like, fuck yeah, man, the goddess is rising again, la, 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 la. And to me, a more wholesome point of view, to me, is there was never any reason to get all pissed off in the first place and start feminism because it was just the alphabet. Like,
yeah.
Don't freak out. It was just, you know, a consequence of using the alphabet. Now, use your media ecology, claim full couple responsibility for everything that happens to you, and then there's, like, no one to hate or forgive rise above or any of that bullshit, you know?
And that's why McClellan dropped value judgments in his public speaking. He said, how can I indict a whole people for the effects of television? You know?
Yeah.
We need to stop being motivated somnambulists, but you don't bring in value judgments or finger-pointing when you're dealing with new machines and their environments and effects. Yeah.
Right. And so in addition to, like, feminism, all this, like, resurgence, which is a subgroup of the New Age culture,
yeah,
where people are specifically Wiccan and they're practicing witchcraft and, you know, you're going to get invited to the Imbolc festival and all that, like, and bubble around the cauldron and, like, be really pissed because there were the witch hunts years ago. Like, there's no need for that. You know what I mean? That's a waste of time.
It's a waste of perception.
Right, it's a waste of perception. And then I did have another really, can I tell my personal thing now?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm done and we can move on to something else. I had something, I had tagged you on a post on my Facebook where I had mentioned in some other INets that a friend of from high school had written an essay for Valentine's Day.
That was male. I just looked at the male story, right?
It's a male story. So this is a friend that I knew from high school who grew up and he became a movie producer in Hollywood. So he's worked on the Pink Panther movie and Hostel, and he also wrote and made a movie called The Rainbow Tribe. Neat guy.
Right, so he has an audience.
Like, he has an audience, and, like, I just think he's real. I thought he was neat when we were 16. I think he's really neat now. Like, if someone's going to admire me, this is going to make me feel fantastic. It's going to make me feel like a goddess that he admires me. So he wrote this essay, and what it was here I was 16, and I was going to the prom with Suzanne. This is, and he used our real names. He used Katie and Suzanne.
He's a friend. Are you part of this story?
I was part of this story.
Okay.
And I just happened to see it. Like, he didn't say, I wrote this essay about you. He just posted the essay that he wrote on his blog on his Facebook, and I happened to click on it and read it today when I'm getting ready for this talk with you tonight.
Yeah.
And so he says, I was going to prom with this girl, Suzanne. I had never kissed someone before, and she had never kissed someone before, and this was supposed to be our night to have a kiss. And Suzanne was the prettiest girl in school. She had it all. And the way he described this, and he didn't mean this. This is what I got out of the story.
Well, wait a minute. What you're saying now is not in the story.
No, this little part right here is not in the story.
Right.
He describes Suzanne, and I know I remember her like it was yesterday, as a Sophia-ish person, as a Sophia-type woman. She's beautiful like Isabella Rossellini, which he did say, or Elizabeth Taylor, that she was this abstract, beautiful woman that he was going to prom with. But he didn't feel that way about her. He secretly liked Katie, me, but Katie wouldn't have gone out with me because she knew she would have had to incur Suzanne's wrath. So you see, it's set up. And Katie was a rogue girl who had a reputation for making out with boys.
And that's what he wants. He wants to be. He wants to make out. He doesn't want the pedestal woman. He wants the throwaway juju.
Well, and it wasn't really throwaway juju because that's a little bit more it was more...
Well, you just said you would be more tactile for him. You would be more involved with him.
Correct.
In what he wanted to do on that night. Okay, great.
Right.
And did you know about this? Were you aware of the tension he had?
No, I mean,
I heard it today.
It was the most beautiful gift. I'll tell you what, it was just lovely in terms of this whole alphabet versus the goddess thing. It was like a little personal redemption thing.
Right.
And, you know, basically it just said that the date finished and he walked up to the door and he tried to have this first kiss with her and it was awful and he felt nothing and he felt gypped and he couldn't believe that this was all about her first kiss. What about his first kiss? And that...
Well, wait, I need to interrupt there. Who said it was about her first kiss? Why is
she did, because this girl was really domineering. So I would not have ever... there wouldn't have been an opportunity for me to date him because she was so powerful within our little school system that she had her eye on him, and that was going to be her date, and that was going to be the way that was going to go.
Right, and so she wanted him.
Yeah, and so she had him for the date, and then she had him for the kiss, and it was awful.
And he couldn't do it. Why did he say he couldn't do it?
Well, he could do it. He just didn't feel anything. It was just forced, and it was pressure, and it was and it
right.
was it was just not good. And then he said, "He'll kiss her if he wants to." He did kiss her, but it was not nothing. It was not good. It was bad.
And,
it was nothing.
And he doesn't know what she thinks.
No, because it's 40 years later.
Yeah.
36 years. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
And then in the essay, what he says was, and I think that I went from being a prince in her eyes to being a toad because I didn't care anymore. I was free. I was free to be kissed
right.
by Katie. And I did kiss him later in that year. And his first kiss, and he said it was awesome.
He said it was awesome.
Nice.
Now, wait a minute. How did you guys get together?
After they weren't dating anymore, we went on some dates.
Well, that would be in the summer.
I honestly don't remember. He would have to tell me.
Well, proms are in May, June, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. It had to be in the summer. Who knows?
Probably a great summer.
It wasn't that significant to me. I don't remember. He's going to have to tell me. I've kissed a lot of boys. I kissed every cute boy in my school.
Before the kiss with him.
Before, during, and after. I had kissed by 13. I was a good kisser at 16.
Okay, now I have this. Remember the commercial I posted? The teenagers... It's all about Bob, you know. Well, I got a date with Bob. Remember that commercial?
Mm-hmm.
I posted around yesterday. You didn't see it? It's on.
No, I'll have to go and look.
Yeah, well, in it.
Sorry, I'll go and look.
Yeah, you got the girl working on the cafeteria, working, you know, serving the burgers or something. She's got a date with Bob. She wants to know what time it is. And a few other expendable jujubes are in there. Say, no, I have a date with Bob. And then they have this, probably the one who gets the high marks in the school, perfectly coiffed and dressed. And she says, like, abstractly, Bob's a rather wild guy. And then they show the other people arguing with Bob, and they come back to her, and she goes, that is good. She's Sophia. You look at it. She's the Sophia Susan image in the group there.
Okay.
She's the abstract beauty. In love with ideas, you know.
Yes. And so it was just so nice as I'm doing this little... You know, I don't feel like as a feminist that I need to have the goddess redeemed or anything. But in this little exercise, as I've been reading this book and today, to get that from him and basically have him write an essay that people are looking at from high school that said, I wish I could have picked Katie over this girl and kind of did, like to be just so... to be the earthy, lusty earth mother and be the one who was wanted in this little story was just a sweet little thing to have happen to me, especially...
That's like the Matrix. You know how they say in the future of the Matrix, everybody has reality working for them. They give you the news today for Katie. This is the Matrix. Yeah, and we're giving Katie a fake story, making her think that she's special.
I know. It's exactly what it is. And it's delicious and yummy. I'm just like, and then we had a little I mean, very appropriate. I'm married. He's got a serious girlfriend. I mean, it doesn't matter now. This is just a sweet little thing that happened 30 years ago. But just so respectful. Like, I feel like any misogyny damage that was, like, in me anywhere that had yet to come up for to be released or be healed, that's really new age and queer. But it just, I mean, this last little thing just took it away. It was just sweet.
You mean you got healed? It was the final healing.
It was the final heal, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a couple ideas about this. So you could write comments. Now, first of all, anybody in high school you're in touch with notice it and say, hey, Katie, it's about you. Anybody do that to you?
I mean, when I first read it, one person had already commented and said, oh, my God, you're talking about Suzanne Sorrell and Katie Winichuk, aren't you? Before I had even read it. And you didn't
see that when you read it. You read it without knowing that.
No, because I saw the comment first. So before.
Oh, okay. So you knew what was coming.
I knew it was coming.
Right.
But I didn't know what it was going to say. So I was actually really kind of scared when I was reading it.
Right, right.
I had to read it a couple of times because I was so afraid.
Well, you went through the drama. See, now
I went through the drama.
Yeah, now, so did, but nobody in high school from there got in touch with you and said, hey, you won or something. Nobody has said anything about you, right?
No, they mostly said, because it's really a story about him feeling awkward about his kiss. I'm just
you have not heard from any high school friends or non-friends.
They have commented to him about his experience, but I haven't had any girl say to me.
Yeah. Hey,
no.
Way to go, Katie. Okay.
Now, you better
now,
believe
here's
I forwarded.
Now, this is why you're only 1 year old. You can only be 1 year old today. You know, 100 years ago, nobody could write something and have everybody see it. Therefore, that whole experience that would never be communicated to you in your life ever again, you'd never bump into anybody, no letters would be written about it, it never would happen. So the Matrix, the media, the Android main, makes it possible for you to go back and relive when you were 18 and go through the healing of something. Beg your pardon?
No.
See, it's a reality, and it's retrievable. And so, therefore, all parts of your life, like all parts of my chart, are all happening at the same time. It just depends on which media experience evokes it. You play these oldies I play. It brings it all back. You're back, you know, you are the moment that you had back then when you heard the music. So this makes us not have biological aging or not have mental aging. You can't leave kindergarten with more media retrievals like this.
Right.
Which is, it changes your whole sense of this is why there's a popular meme, Carol, of anti-aging. People are already not aging mentally because they have every experience is retrieved and replayed in the media all the time. So you don't, whereas before, you would age and you'd have experiences way back there that you can't have again. And nobody could replay. You might have a dance around the maypole or somebody, a singer pass through the town and sing a couple of songs you heard 20 years ago. That would be a little flashback slightly, right? But this is an important point that the measurements of chemical body and the normal chronological aging of experience that a chemical body has is not possible today.
Huh? Very good.
And Ion is just normally in touch with the time. He's saying, learn these basic points because they can even be proven by secular thinkers, not just, non-physical. But non-physical knows that's what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's what you mean by getting healed. He took you right back there. You were there, right back in grade. Oh, my God, what's going to happen? Am I going to get nailed or what? You know what I mean? And you lived it out while you read it.
It was just delicious. It was so. It was great.
A great victory. Yeah. Now you're thinking it was great. Now you're saying it's great to be 18. You're still 18.
Well, you know, I forwarded it privately to some of my girlfriends and was like, "Read this. I won."
With no warning. You didn't tell them what they would read.
Oh, no, but I was like, read this. Look at a picture of him, too, because he's just such a neat guy. Like, it would have been different, too, if he was, like, some big nerd or something. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Right.
But he's just a great guy. And maybe we'll take my novels and he'll make those into movies.
Right. Yeah. Maybe I'll get to fuck them. And hey, you'll introduce me and I'll fuck them.
Yeah.
Bring up the gay part that he didn't know he had in high school after he was disappointed.
Right. So it's like in that in those Hershey walls.
Yeah, yeah. So the guy is doing pretty good as all American achiever. And he was he good looking in high school?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So he's one of these handsome guys that get everything. You know what I mean? Success comes pretty easy to them because they look good. And at least people will talk to them.
Right.
Oh, that reminds me. No, it doesn't. There was something.
His dad owned the local movie theater.
Oh, so he was already into The Matrix, that part of it. Well, and now he's in Hollywood. Well, the family must love him. You know, he went from consumer to producer,
right,
of movies.
Right.
I'm just getting flat. There was something about the beach, Carol, I discovered. I got to talk about that, but I forget what it was. There's a new aspect. So it's just, oh, Jesus, I haven't checked the goddamn inventory for an hour.
Let's no, it's see. Been two.
2 hours? Did you get an email, Carolyn? Let's see.
Nope,
he's not here yet. Okay, so we're okay. Well, that's a great story, great review of the book. And now I imagine, I haven't looked at there's probably millions of comments going on. Can you look at the comment board?
Can I?
Yeah, do you know how to do that? No, you... Usually they're talking about other things, but there might be a comment or two on what we've been talking about. The most McLuhan-esque guy you'll get on there is Minimax. You know, he's... Mm-hmm. I met him at my talk at the McLuhan Center. So Minimax is... Now, Sue's commenting, the hunter's male and gather's female, now we are both in the chip body. They merge. Right, information hunters. That's right. And as you were saying, the women had the edge with the typing in the 80s. They moved right up because they could type faster than the men did. There's a lot of interesting commentary. So I can't go. We'll have to read that later, maybe. Minimax is mentioning Daniel. Minimax mentioned Daniel Pinchbeck, who I met. When was that? Severo Latrinji took me to a party. And I ended up talking to Pinchbeck, and he was, he wrote a book about his religious quest and trying out Ibogaine and Terence McKenna Land and all this stuff. And he was interested in medium, so I told him about the Evergreens. And he said, oh, I'd like to have a session with them. So I started to arrange for him to get a session with the Evergreens before he went away, 2 weeks later. And there was no room for him. It was all booked up. So Pinchbeck never got a session with the Evergreens, and then he went on his, 2-year journey, which became this book that he wrote, which I guess Minimax has read. And what was the first one?
He's a 2012 guy. He had this thing called Reality Sandwich, too.
That's right. And I was with him when he was doing that in Manhattan. I would go to their meetings, to their talks, and... I attempted to wake them up as I tried to attempt to wake every subculture there, Peter Lamborn Wilson, you know, and the anarchists and the WBA, every one of them, they were not interested in the big picture. And so for me, they were all at issue with me, and they all flunked. Meanwhile, they got books out and got to be on coast to coast or this talk show or that, and they make a little money. And think that they're a culture hero, and they had no clue of the scorn that was pouring out for me at every one of them. And if you had written your book back then, you would have been scorned at the high hill. Okay. So now I would
probably not be scorned.
Yeah, you were. Bob's scorn turns out to be pretty powerful. As Ian says, you don't want to piss off Bob. Well, old Pinchbeck, he'd be perfectly into Ion, but he'll never find it. He's too busy trying to start a new age or tribal retrieval post-McKenna replay through his little magazines and that, you know, and... Yeah. and survive as an information purveyor, so he doesn't have to work in the factories or in McDonald's.
Right.
That's all they're doing. They just don't want to work. They got to come up with some software gig, some information pattern marketing scheme, which I'm accused of all the fucking time. And Minimax is the only guy who points out, I have talked to Bob for 20 years. What is it? Yeah, 20, what is it? 10 years. And not one cent has been exchanged between us. How could he be a fraud? The other guys are calling me a fraud. And he says, all I get from the Church of Genius is money debts, money expenses, but not from Bobby. I don't charge for anything. So that's why I was chosen to lead into the 22nd century. I'm strictly non-commercial. All right, back to... But let's see if Minimax is commenting on that. Minimax says, interesting, he's responding to me. He needed to find the medium inside his head instead. That's right. He thought that he... now, that's a retrieving of visual space. That's trying to expand your inner sub-vocalized voice that you use when you read. So this whole psychic New Age thing is enhancing the effect of the printing press and trying to retrieve it, but loosening it up, making it, make yourself a channeler. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. they don't know that there's something outside of this that is not to undermine you, but it's sort of like outside of you because you got to get out of your stupid head to even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're not, a lot of these people, very involved inside their head, writing books, broadcasting, talking, and all this stuff. They miss the big stuff, which mm-hmm. is huge. Now, Minimax, who's a great fan of Terrence McKenna and will defend McKenna against whatever I say, is doing it again here. Pinchbeck isn't so silly. See, he's going to defend Pinchbeck to me, against me, or whatever he thinks I'm saying, but it doesn't work. I mean, Pinchbeck is not getting Katie on here, a full-flown, ascended intellectual, former associate among psychopaths, skilled, no-children woman, and getting interested in Bob knowledge. Now, that's an achievement. It doesn't count when you get a bunch of, Madeline in San Francisco who's into ayahuasca. Now, she'd love Pinchbeck. Pinchbeck could get hers knowledge, but we even got Madeline over here on our side. So that's an achievement. So Pinchbeck and them are short-term jujubes. Pinchbeck is the male is expendable jujube. Because only women read books, so all these guys like Michael Brown, you guys all went for it's the women who prop up these gurus.
Right.
You guys actually read books. It's all a new experience for you. And mm-hmm. so they become expendable jujubes. Dobbs will never be an expendable jujube.
Oh, no.
No. Okay, what's he say? He says, Minimax says, I was there when DP, Daniel Pinchbeck, heroically tried to hijack BM Center Camp stage during Katrina. And who would be BM? Would that be, I'm thinking of Kino, the black guy, Keefe West or something. Who would be... and then he goes, William Irwin Thompson is all over. That's right. Pinchbeck is totally Thompson's quadrant. That's where the evergreens and mediums are, and that's what he went. He had the best medium. He almost had the best medium, but he never got the best medium. See, that's why he's a loser. He doesn't get any of Dobbstown. A loser in the collective sense, not between me and him. We're not talking personally. We're talking about the collective meme that everybody has to deal with up to a point. In that way, he's a loser. And Dobbstown isn't. Dobbs is totally in charge of this Andor meme that afflicts everybody. And then Allison goes, this is getting good. Madeline doesn't love Pinchbeck? Seriously? No, I'm saying she does love Pinchbeck up till about 6 months ago. Now she's into Dobbstown. All right? Well, wait till Madeline hears about this. She'll support. And Minimax is Burning Man. Okay, so what is... Oh, Burning Man. Okay. During Katrina. So that would be 2005. Minimax, I guess. I know he went out to a couple, at least one Burning Man. BM means Burning Man. I thought he meant in New Orleans. Okay, so he tried to hijack it. And well, tell us, what did he do? Did he succeed? What happened? Type away there, Minimax. But yes, Daniel Pinchbeck, And these guys, they avoid the alphabet and the goddess. They do not want to look at media dynamics. Now, part of the problem of bringing up media dynamics now, Katie, is that there are no such things as individual media, as McLuhan wrote about it in Understanding Media. There isn't radio and TV. So McLuhan is obsolete in that way. People are trying to find out their identity within, they would admit that there's a matrix and an Android meme that's sneaking around them and maybe not even dominating them because they're Web 2.0, they can edit it away. But you can't even, so this stuff that's McLuhan, you can't get them interested in it, but they don't know it. And you need to know this phase because it gets you out of all the old other arguments that you get into, the obsolete arguments, you see?
Yep, I do. Plus, it's just so fun. It's so much more fun than all woo all the time. It really is. It's nice just to have something that's...
Well, that's what Ion's for. This is practical.
Yeah.
That's why Ion says after Ion, you get a good chunk, you then go to Bob, which means you go to these writers, thinkers, creators, practical satellite conductors.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I know I've said this week after week, but once I start writing, which I'm going to, my anniversary in Dobbstown is April 1st, April Fool's Day.
Right.
That's when I'm going to start. I'm going to pick up my novel again. I haven't looked at it in a while. I'm so excited to be all Miss Smarty Pants in my books.
They have new stuff to write.
So legitimate. So, I mean, this could be a talk for a PhD class.
Your part, at least. Yeah.
You know, that's pretty darn cool.
Right. Now, so you have something to say. At least your audience doesn't know this. You know, CIA knows it.
Right.
But your audience, whoever would buy whatever your story is that's going to attract certain people, they don't know. It'll be new knowledge for them.
Right.
Well, we'll see you on Charlie Rose someday.
Well, if I'm on Charlie Rose, I'm bringing your ass with me, Bob. I ain't going on there alone.
Well, don't let, if they say no, go on anyways. You know, don't make that a condition.
They don't want me on there.
They don't want me on there.
Oh, you can be all silly, too, and we'll work away.
No, I don't get silly. If I was ever in there,
that's silly. That was the wrong word.
You wouldn't even be talked about. It would be cut and slash, and I'm on here once. I'm taking advantage of it. The heck with whatever Katie wrote about.
And I didn't mean silly. I meant Bob.
Okay. All right.